Good afternoon, and now all the recording devices, I think, are running. This is, have a red blinking light?
Yes, it does.
Good. Okay, then we're in good shape. This is part two of our discussion of misdirected emails. We wish a refuah shlema to Jonathan, who is not able to be here today. Ralph is going to take over for him as our chair. But thank you to Jonathan for arranging everything, arranging the lunch, and to Schweitz Levitsky Feldman for once again supplying lunch. I'm going to pass around the sign-in sheet for people to be able to sign in. If you sign in, that way you will get follow-up on this program and notices about the future lunches here. The third column, if you check or write yes, then you'll receive a weekly email that advertises our programs in general. To be different, I'm going to start on this side and have it go around this way instead. Ralph has a special announcement at the end, which ties into the cards that are sitting on the table, the donation opportunity cards. So that will go with Ralph's announcement at the end, but feel free to take them and fill them out. You can give them back to me. You can mail them in. Again, that will come with Ralph's explanation. I want to begin by recapping a little bit from last time, because this is part two of our discussion of leaked information, reading other people's information, and so forth. Last time we talked about reading misdirected emails, and we said there are five issues of Jewish law involved in reading somebody else's mail. One was that mail is an extension of the person, and therefore you are invading the person's privacy. Second was that mail is the person's property, and taking their mail is a misuse of their property. Third, we said mail is a person's communication, and you can't force somebody to communicate in ways that they didn't intend to. That's what we called rechilus, tail-bearing. Fourth, we said that telling about somebody else, even telling yourself about somebody else, is a tort. It's actually an assault on them, and a violation of love your neighbor as yourself, and so forth. And then fifth, we said it's a violation of public policy, and we mentioned Rabbeinu Gershom's decree, the decree attributed to Rabbeinu Gershom, not to read other people's mail. Separate from any discussion, of course, about Dina de Malchus Adina, the law of the land, forbidding reading that person's information. So we said you would be allowed to read or see information that is intentionally disclosed carelessly. So a person sends a postcard and writes it where everybody can see it, that's not your problem. We discussed it in terms of leaked information, stuff that's already available online, but the three cases I want to talk about this time, as we talk about the permissible espionage, as I put it on the sheet, are the following. Number one, monitoring an employee's email. Number two, the case of Apple versus the FBI, which, you know, is back in the news now as an Israeli company was able to hack the iPhone involved. So the question of whether Apple has the right to refuse to share the information or to access the information from the phone. And then third, the issue of spying on a spouse. And what if someone suspects the spouse is doing something wrong? Would one be allowed to do that? Now, for the sake of clarity, I'm going to pretend in all of our cases that all of the people involved, the heroes and the villains, are all Jewish. Because otherwise you get into layer upon layer of complication as to which laws are Noahide laws for all human beings and which laws are specifically for Jews. And it's just going to confuse things beyond getting anything done in the time frame that we have. So we start with the issue of reading an employee's email. What would you assume going in? Knowing that you're not allowed to read someone's email if it is misdirected to you, would Jewish law permit you to monitor an employee's email?
I know we have all our staff and partners sign a declaration on an annual basis that says that your work email is not private or confidential anyway, and we reserve the right to get it. I presume that if Jewish law were to allow it, it would be only if you had signed such a declaration.
Okay.
But would you do that?
So one suggestion Ralph says is, yes, it can be done, but only if you actually have affirmative agreement from the employee to this sort of monitoring. Any thought to the contrary?
So, does it have to be cause?
Does there have to be cause?
You have to suspect some impropriety?
Well, that will be an open question, right? Would that change? Would that change things? In other words, let's say I have an employee. There is no signed agreement. However, I'm getting a sense that the employee is in fact selling our secrets, or you know, what, downloading files that are not to be downloaded from the network. Would I then perhaps be allowed to investigate without getting permission? Yeah.
Another aspect is like the signed declaration that Rob mentioned, but under required. Did you sign or did you lose your job?
Right. What happens at Schwartz, Levinsky, Feldman if somebody says, I'd rather not sign?
Well, you don't work yet, basically.
Right.
That's
so,
the condition of working yet.
So can you force someone into this? So let's take a look at the first couple of sources here, which reflect what Ralph has reported as the practice here. Within secular law, there's an expectation of privacy unless the employer informs otherwise. So this is a Supreme Court of Canada decision from 2012 where the majority, right, McLaughlin as well as Labelle, Fish, Rothstein, Cromwell, and I don't know how he pronounces it, Moldaver, okay. Computers that are reasonably used for personal purposes, whether found in the workplace or the home, contain information that is meaningful, intimate, and touching on the user's biographical core. Canadians may therefore reasonably expect privacy in the information contained on these computers, at least where personal use is permitted or reasonably expected. Ownership of property is a relevant consideration, but is not determinative, meaning the fact that the company owns the computer network, you know, is the one that's enabling the communication and so forth, may give them certain rights, but it doesn't demonstrate that they own access to the information that's there. Workplace policies are also not determinative of a person's reasonable expectation of privacy. So if there's a policy at work that says no personal emails, that doesn't necessarily allow them to access the email on the computer and say, we're going to check to make sure that your emails aren't personal. Whatever the policies state, one must consider the totality of the circumstances in order to determine whether privacy is a reasonable expectation in the particular situation. While workplace policies and practices may diminish an individual's expectation of privacy in a work computer, these sorts of operational realities do not in themselves remove the expectation entirely. It's possible for an employee to think that even though they banned personal emails, that doesn't mean that they're going to open my email account in order to check. A reasonable, though diminished, expectation of privacy is nonetheless a reasonable expectation of privacy protected by Section 8 of the Charter. Accordingly, it is subject to state intrusion only under the authority of a reasonable law. So the default is that you're going to have privacy. They're not able to check, even if what you're talking about doing is inappropriate. I mean, the case R.V. Cole. I don't know if anyone is familiar with the case involved. It was a school teacher whose school computer had child pornography on it, and it was discovered by somebody on the staff of the school, and they immediately put the stuff on CD and took it to the authorities. And the argument is that the teacher on this work computer has the right to expect privacy, and therefore it's actually an inappropriate accessing of the information. That's the particular case that the Supreme Court is commenting on. But source number two shows you what is generally recommended, and it is the policy that Ralph mentioned as well, which is, and if an employer plans to monitor an employee's email or internet use, then ideally the employer should obtain the employee's written consent in advance via computer use policy. Right? It's common sense. Just get your permission in advance. Such a policy tells the employee that the employer will be monitoring emails and internet use and that the employee should have no expectation of privacy, The employer can require all new employees to sign a computer use policy which obtains the employee's written consent as a condition of employment. In other words, the objection of, well, this is coercion, doesn't apply. Because if you don't like it, don't work here.
Well,
I don't know if I quite employ that here. Because, well, the difference is that that's a term that we usually use regarding doing a mitzvah. Compelling someone to do a mitzvah. This is compelling somebody to sign away his privacy in order to get a job. That might be a reason to distinguish. See the Magen Mishnah on the Rambam in Hilchos Gittin, where, well, he'll take it further. But, yeah.
And then, since civil law, also in Jewish law.
So now that's what we need to talk about. This is the secular system. Number two was the advice of the McLeod law firm. I picked a generic one. You can find any number of law firms that discuss this issue, which have basically identical advice. Within halacha, it's actually fairly straightforward. Number one, the employer is under no obligation to provide an untapped line of communication. That's not an employer's responsibility. You want private communication? Bring your own device. And it's also true the employer is going to have to notify people if they could have had any presumption, reasonable presumption, Chaim, of privacy. However, there is one interesting note that I wanted to add to this from the perspective of Jewish law, and that is, if you're talking about personal emails, you know, online shopping, whatever it is, within Jewish law, the employer is very much within his rights to expect employees not to engage in the shopping, the personal emails, and so on company time. And Jewish law is actually very strict in this regard. The Talmud discusses in the laws of brachas, laws of blessings, the status of birkat hamazon, blessing after meals. Let's say your boss says, you're working for me from sunrise to sunset, right? You're working in the fields, whatever it is. You're allowed to take a lunch break. So take a lunch break, but don't take more than a lunch break. You finish eating lunch, and then you're going to recite the blessing after meals. How much of it are you allowed to recite? Because as long as you are speaking those words, you are taking time away from work. Argues the Talmud, and it is brought as law, that that there are four key blessings as part of Birkat HaMazon. The first three are biblical obligations, the fourth one is rabbinic. And then the other things that we add on after that, Harachman and so on. The Talmud says you only say the first three. You don't say the fourth. And you certainly don't say the things that are added on at the end. It's less applicable post-Talmudic times, both in terms of the way that work goes and the expectations of your employer, and in terms of how long, frankly, people take to actually say those words, which is another discussion. But the but that shows you how seriously they view use of the employer's time for which you're paid for anything other than the task at hand. Take a look, please, at source number three. I brought you two 12th century sources reflecting different parts of the Jewish world. One is the Rambam, writing in Egypt and certainly speaking as a leading voice of Sephardic law. And then the other is Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, whose writings often form a key part of the basis of Ashkenazi halacha. He's writing in Germany. Rambam Maimonides writes, I'm going to read the English out for you. You can see the Hebrew there, though, for those who want to look at it. Just as the employer must not steal the wages of a pauper or delay them, so the pauper must not steal the work of the employer and waste a little here, a little there, wasting the whole day cunningly. Rather, he must be precise with his time, for the sages were so precise that they said not to recite the fourth blessing of Birkat HaMazon, as I mentioned. So what Maimonides says, he calls the worker a pauper, because part of Maimonides' philosophy, and this goes to a larger topic, which is the employer-employee relationship, but part of Maimonides' philosophy of business is that you would not be selling your time to the employer unless you needed the money. And therefore, by default, the employee is viewed as a needy person who is selling his time and efforts to the employer. That's why he words it in this way. It's part of a larger discussion about the employer as benefactor. But that's Maimonides. He says, just like the boss is obligated to pay you on time and to be fastidious about it, so too the employee has to work properly. That's Rambam. And then, on the other side of the Jewish world, number four, Yehuda HaChassid, he writes, one may not speak with school teachers when they are teaching, lest he waste their time with his words. You can't go have a personal conversation with somebody who's supposed to be teaching a class. And he has more to say on it. I brought you one line out of it, but he has more in this regard. So the employer is within his rights to expect employees not to be sending personal emails, not to be shopping online and so forth. However, if he's going to monitor, then he has to actually get permission. He can demand permission, but he actually has to obtain that permission. So that's the first and simplest, I think, part of this discussion. Are we clear on that? Okay. Then let's move to the area where things get more complex. And that is the Apple and the FBI issue. Now, there's one piece of this that I didn't explore, although it's worth thinking about. There's a reference to it in this source that I brought you at number 5. I gave you a link to an article that appears online where there is a little bit of an exploration of it. And that's the question of the status of a democratically elected government in Jewish law. Meaning, Jewish law recognizes the concept of a king. And there's a lot of debate as to what the authority of a king is. And there are two schools. One school of thought that says basically, yeah, a king can do almost whatever he wants. In terms of property and taking things for himself and so on. And then you have another school of thought that says, no, they're very limited in what they can do. So one question that comes up is, what about a government that has a constitution, that has a charter, that protects people's rights? What is the authority of a government? Could you argue they're like a king, and therefore they have unique powers? So I didn't bring it here and go into it here, because I don't think it's so relevant in our case, because here the courts do seem to have the capacity to limit the power of the government, right? As in the Apple versus FBI case, which only didn't go to trial in the end because they found another way to crack the phone. But but once you recognize that courts are able to limit what the king, so to speak, what the government can do, you know you're playing in a different playing field. It's not so relevant to apply authority of a monarchy to the situation. But what we're dealing with fundamentally when we deal with Apple versus the FBI is a philosophical question. What do we do about the privacy of the individual weighed against the needs of society? So I'll make the argument. Should Apple be able to refuse the government's demand? Or is Apple stuck with it and they have to do as the government asks?
Apple doesn't work for the government.
Correct.
The government here is demanding, we demand that you do X for us because we feel the need.
Correct.
Apple's not working for the government. That's an intrusion into Apple's rights as a corporate individual.
Well, that happens all the time, though. In other words, separate from our discussion about privacy, governments have the ability to legislate on behalf of citizens. We have in the U.S., there's OSHA. Right here, there's an equivalent act, the name of which I'm forgetting right now. But the government requires businesses to buy certain types of equipment, to furnish certain types of facilities and so forth, even though the business doesn't work for the government. The government is able to legislate what a business can do.
So that it can do on behalf of a certain segment of individuals. What I'm talking about here is that the government here is now intruding on the right of Apple to function as Apple. The government is now saying that we need something. You have something that we need. Give it to us. The government does not have that right to do. The government can say, you have to provide handicap ramps.
Why do they have the ability to demand handicap ramps and not demand that you turn over information which could help prevent somebody from becoming handicapped?
There's a fundamental difference because they're now making Apple an employee of the government.
But they're now
in their coercive manner. So it's not a tax. I mean, you have to pay taxes, you have to do this, you have to do that. Now I've been saying, Apple, you must work for the government. You must provide us with what we want. Even though it is your proprietary right as a corporate entity, you have this proprietary right, and you have patents on it, et cetera, et cetera. But we want it.
So
we claim to need it. We want it. Give it.
Okay, so Breslow makes the argument that the government cannot compel because you can't force people to do things for the government. I'm not so sure, but Dr. Silverberg wants to respond. And then, no? Okay, Neil.
How's that different to compulsory military service?
Right.
You have to do
a
military service.
One second. What do you do in a military draft?
A military draft is required of all individuals of X age to provide service, except for there are certain exceptions, and whatever whatever the exceptions are. You have a compulsory draft which applies to everyone. That's not forcing you, one individual, who has a specific, you have a specific skill you want, you will do this for us. That's different than a compulsory draft. Everybody has to defend the country. Hey, wonderful. Everybody's got to do it. But I don't have, if I go into the, if I'm working for Apple, and I've got this knowledge, I don't need it for the government. I got basic training. I should have done.
Okay, so the argument is because it's limited to this individual or this company, as opposed to Apple decreeing anybody or the government decreeing anybody who knows how to crack this phone is obligated to do so on our behalf. That you'd be okay with?
Yeah, government can't do that.
No, but you'd be okay with the government issuing a decree saying anybody who can crack this phone is obligated to do so.
No, I'm not.
Why not? That is just like drafting anybody of military age.
Everybody has to draft. Male between right. of 18, you go in, everybody's got
so everybody who has the ability to crack this phone, crack the phone.
No, that's making me do a specific act.
As opposed to going
to shoot the gun, teach me how to shoot the gun, I shoot the gun, shoot the protector.
I'm not convinced. But I'm gonna go around a little bit. Jeffrey and then Janice and then Faye and no one to the side.
By analogy, in a civil lawsuit, the court does have the power upon application by a party to a lawsuit to obtain information from a non-party. So a non-party can be ordered to produce documents. Documents can be anything from a paper document to a video recording to a picture.
Right. So they were able to obtain information.
Right. So the question here is definitely the court could bring an application, which they did, or merely a motion to do the court to obtain that information from Apple. In the Canadian context, that might be governed then by charter issues, or perhaps yes, perhaps not, copyright issues, so forth.
Right.
And the court allowed it, they'd probably, make terms that Apple can crack it, but they don't have to tell the government how to crack it. They just have to give the information.
Right, so to reduce the harm.
Proprietary rights are protected.
Right. But the within subpoenaing information, so to speak.
Yeah.
Okay. Janice?
I would think that in this specific and for a lot of reasons too, that Kunefa should be running in here. I mean, you're talking about the phone of a terrorist who has already done damage, and there could be information on that phone that can help to prevent further attacks, or to find other co-conspirators who were involved. In
right. So the argument is, this is information that could save lives, unless one thinks that this is only a remote supposition. Mm-hmm. When they caught that fellow in Paris, right? They were able to get a whole bunch of information relevant to other attacks that were in the works. So it's not a hypothetical maybe, like this is a substantive concern. Okay.
Again, so following along with this comment here, in the Jeremy Bentham world, the greater good for the greatest number of people. So the greatest good for that number of people should be that we need this information. We, the government that works with you, our population, we need it to help so that another horror like this does not transpire. And we can only do it if you allow us to get into the apple.
So that's you're working with an assumption, though. You're working with the assumption that the greatest number of people will be helped with the information from the phone. What if someone argues to the contrary, that the greatest number of people will benefit from privacy?
I'm just thinking also of money that was put away in the in Switzerland. I think they finally were able to force the Swiss bankers to open up their records.
I don't know enough about how that works, so I'll leave that one because I don't know how that works. Marvin.
I think one of the important things is national security. With the Apple thing, they weren't saying to Apple, open up all the... give us access to anybody's phone that we want to hack. They were dealing with a specific example.
Well, Apple's response... Right, you're right, but Apple's response to that was that this creates a precedent now so that you can then go further with it in any phone. Once we've allowed it once, there's no reason not to then allow the government to keep on doing it under the same logical argument.
But there can be judicial checkmates to make sure that the government doesn't abuse.
Right, hypothetically.
there was a precedent of some sort a few years ago. Obama signed or agreed to a drone killing of an American citizen in Yemen.
Oh, yes.
Because he was instrumental in radicalization of a lot of Muslims. He agreed to it because he wanted us to stop. So you could argue this was a terrorist. They had information on that phone that could also stop the future terrorist.
Well, maybe you're allowed to kill him, but not to break his phone.
He's a rogue agent. You have him under war powers. Whereas Apple, we deal with a dead guy with a phone, which might have.
Well, that raises another question, which is, if you're going to say that a terrorist who is plotting something is a Rodeo, if he is a pursuer of lives, why wouldn't I necessarily say that the phone that could contain the information? Remember that there's a question we discussed, I think, on another occasion, the question of what it takes to classify someone as a pursuer. What if I think he might be out to kill people, but I don't actually know it? What level of certainty do I need? Certainly there's a higher bar when we're talking about killing him than there is with imprisoning him for questioning or something along those lines. David, and then I'm going to go further with this.
Apple has to think of a global market like China and how the privacy of its citizens, and in Europe how citizens there view privacy. And I believe there was a precedent with BlackBerry terrorists in India who attacked Havad House and other places. The encryption on the BlackBerry, they have to negotiate an agreement with the Indian government. So this is something that has to do with every government.
Right. They're going to have to. This isn't one country, one issue. This is a global issue. You're right. But the other issue, which I thought you were going to go towards with this, is you're asking Apple also to subvert its own interests, in the sense that there will be a whole lot of people who, if Apple cracks the phone, are going to either on principle or out of necessity say, well, we're not going to use iPhones anymore. You're actually harming them in the market. So that's another thing to consider. So
better for Apple to provide it, whatever information the authorities require, than having a third party who they have no control over.
Apparently they didn't feel that way. But it's an interesting question. It's an interesting business question. Right. I'm going to go further with this because there is so much more.
So you could take a different view. I wouldn't be very happy with that.
You could argue that now I'm anti-Apple. Okay, well, you can buy a BlackBerry. Kitchener Waterloo will be very happy. So three different approaches that I outlined here on the sheet. The first approach says subvert individual privacy rights in order to protect our judicial system. Meaning, going back to what Jeffrey had said, the government has the ability, the courts have the ability, really, it's not government, the courts have the ability to access information. If the courts come to Apple and say, we want this information that's on the phone, not because of national security, but because this is a criminal's information and we need it in order to prosecute a case. So the argument would be that that protection of the judicial system overrides the rights of the owner of the phone. That's one argument. A second argument is that it's about protecting his potential victims. And because there might be information that could be used to thwart attacks, therefore we are going to override his personal privacy rights. Those first two arguments argue in favor of cracking the phone. But then the third argument responds and says, well, wait a minute, maybe we should ignore the danger to potential victims. We don't know who they are, we don't know how many they are, we don't know if there are any, in order to protect the privacy rights of society as a whole. I'm going to go a little further first, because otherwise we're not going to finish, and they're going to come in.
The fourth argument that it's important.
Okay.
So the fourth argument that is very strong is that if there's a code to crack the phone, that can be stolen by the hackers or the crooks. So you're opening the door to more crime.
You're opening the door to crime by cracking the phone.
No, because it means you have a key to crack it.
Right.
That eventually the hackers can find.
But they're working on this anyway. The hackers are the ones you should have gone to in the first place. they're the ones who are trying anyway. You're going to say now it's more vulnerable because now people become aware of it? Actually, I would argue the opposite, because there was a news piece that came out after the Israeli company, Cellbright, actually cracked the phone. They said it's unlikely that this will be usable in the future because Apple will figure out how they did it, and it's going to close it, and therefore it's not going to actually be relevant further. You know, that's like the white hat hackers who, you know, do this for the companies. But I'm going to go further with this, because really there's a lot to say. So the first question is, there are really two fundamental questions. The first question is, does Apple have an obligation under Jewish law, pretending again that it's a kosher apple, right, that everybody's Jewish involved. So would Apple have an obligation to break the phone under one of the first two approaches that we mentioned, for the sake of protecting the victims or for the sake of the judicial system? And then number two, the second question is, if Apple refuses, whether they're obligated to or not, if Apple refuses, does the government have the ability in Jewish law to say, do it anyway, and to force them? So, first, under the question of whether Apple has an obligation, there is a basic mitzvah, which I brought you in source number 7. There's a basic mitzvah in the Torah that requires people to testify. If someone has a case and needs witnesses, and you have the ability to testify, you have a mitzvah of testifying with severe penalties if you refuse to do so.
Doesn't that present a problem? About 15 years ago, there was a case here of a kid from a Sun Yeshiva in Toronto who committed suicide because he knew that he'd have to stand, he'd have to be a witness to trial against his Rebbe who abused him.
I mean, that's a terrible case, and obviously laws have to be applied with seichel in terms of protecting people who are going to have to testify. But this is, you know, the requirement. The core requirement is, yes, people are required to testify. And if you'll say, well, wait a minute, society needs privacy, that fundamentally does not override the justice system. That's a basic that's a basic point, arguing it under the under that approach, under approach number one. However, I think there is a difference here. And the difference here is that Apple doesn't have the testimony right now. Apple doesn't know what's on the phone. And there is no mitzvah to go out and acquire testimony in order to be able to testify. Would it be considered chesed, an act of kindness, if I know that somebody is going to have an event of some kind that requires testimony, so is there a mitzvah for me to go be there as a witness in order to be able to testify afterwards? I don't believe so. In the same way that we don't say there's a mitzvah of go out and get a job so you will have money so you'll be able to give tzedakah. Right? It's a noble thing to do, but it's not an obligation. There's no mitzvah of, mitzvah in the sense of obligation. There's no obligation of go to medical school so that you will be able to become a doctor so that you will be able to save lives. It may be a good thing to do, and in a shir a few years ago I argued for it actually being some level of obligation, but at its core it's very hard to say that you have an obligation to do that. And so Apple could respond, if we had the information, we would have to turn it over. But we don't have the information, and we're not obligated to go get it. However, look at the second approach. The second approach says it's not about the judicial system. Rather, it's about protecting citizens. So we have a basic principle. I brought you the verse in source number 8, right? Lo samad al dam ra'acha, do not stand by as somebody else's blood is shed. You have an obligation to intervene to prevent the shedding of blood. Now, we'll say, well, society has a need for privacy, but that does not override protection of individuals. You have to minimize what you're going to tell. But the obligation to tell is there. I brought you source number 9, one of the most famous examples. Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, in his work on harmful speech, writes, one who sees that his friend wishes to partner with another, he's going to go into business with him, and who knows this will definitely cause bad results, must tell him in order to save him from that bad fate. Now, he outlines a whole bunch of rules to minimize what you're going to tell. But absolutely, you tell, and it's a stronger formulation in Jewish law than it is in secular law. Take a look at source number 10 from Ontario's Personal Health Information Protection Act. Just rolls off the tongue. Source number 10. A health information custodian may disclose personal health information about an individual if the custodian believes on reasonable grounds that the disclosure is necessary for the purpose of eliminating or reducing a significant risk of serious bodily harm to a person or a group of persons. There's that word reasonable again, right? But the health information custodian is allowed to disclose the information in order to eliminate or reduce a risk of serious bodily harm. Similarly, I brought you the Law Society's rule in source number 11. where a lawyer believes upon reasonable grounds that there is an imminent risk to an identifiable person or group of death or serious bodily harm, including dot, 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 the lawyer may disclose, pursuant to judicial order where practicable, confidential information where it is necessary to do so in order to prevent the death or harm, but shall not disclose more information than is required. So secular law also says to tell, but do you notice the differences between secular and Jewish law? There are two differences. What are they? May is one difference. Source 10 and Source 11 both say the health information custodian, as well as the lawyer, may tell. Whereas Jewish law says must. Right? This is part of the whole concept of duty to rescue. Where Jewish law requires you to rescue, the secular law, certainly in Ontario, it varies a little bit in different places, but Ontario has no duty to rescue. There is no obligation for you to do so. That's one difference. What's the other difference? Sarah?
In Jewish law, it's financial harm, whereas in secular law, it has to be bodily harm.
Good. That wasn't explicit in what we saw here, but that is argued that in Jewish law, the obligation will extend to financial harm. Based on the Talmud in Sanhedrin, when it discusses this obligation to intervene, Sanhedrin Ayin Gimel, one of the examples it gives for intervening is an example where someone is just losing his property. You still have an obligation to intervene. So you're right, there's the financial harm. What else? There was a subtlety in source number 11. One word.
Wouldn't be reasonable ground.
No?
No.
Yeah?
Imminent risk?
Nope.
The last word required.
Nope. Identifiable. Has to be to an identifiable person or group. That is a loaded, loaded word. What about the following case? You have I'll give you an actual one. This happened in California. A woman received AIDS from a tainted blood transfusion. Okay, she received HIV, developed into AIDS, and then transmitted it to her boyfriend 5 years later. The boyfriend sues the hospital. Why didn't you take the step to notify me that she was sick? Does the boyfriend win or lose? The boyfriend loses. Why? Because he wasn't dating her at the time of the transmission, and the hospital has no duty to inform an unidentifiable third party. What are they going to do? Take out ads in the newspaper? Such and such a woman has developed AIDS? What are you actually going to do? So the rule is that it's only where it's an identifiable party. Jewish law will not necessarily accept that limitation. I brought you source number 12, which deals with that issue. I'm not going to read it aloud. I brought it more for your interest. But there's an issue of requiring a clearly identified party, I think largely because once you require people to intervene to save unidentified parties, it becomes such a broad and unreasonable expectation that you can't do anything with it. Meaning, are we really going to say that every time I become aware, let's say I heard there was a recall, right? They recalled tuna because of some risk of bacterial, whatever it was, in the tuna. You probably saw it. I hope you saw it. Because my question is, do I have an obligation now with this information to send chain emails far and wide, and buy a billboard, and put out the information, because there is an unidentified person who is at risk? How far do you go? And this can really create a tremendous responsibility. But applying this back to the Apple case, their argument could be, it's an identifiable person. We don't know who's at risk, if anyone. So maybe we could argue, therefore, that we're not responsible. Yes?
Would that hospital have a continued relationship with the person that
I don't know. It's a good question. Right. It's an interesting question. That case comes from the article that I brought in number 12. So if we look it up, this article from the Journal of Legal Medicine, we will know. I don't remember the facts of the case in terms of whether they had an ongoing connection such that they could have then found out. Yeah.
In the case of the Apple, can we say that we are sort of in a state of semi-war with ISIS and all those components? And so therefore, in a state of war, there are certain things that are permissible.
So you raise a whole other, right, that's a whole other specter, which I didn't really think about going into this. In this case in particular, this fellow, I think, in the end, was not considered to be, he was ISIS-inspired, so to speak. He read it online, but he had no connection to the network, that's my understanding, which could be wrong. But it's a very interesting question. How would this calculation change if it were time of war? I think things do change. I'm not sure. I have to think it through, but it's a good question. So what we've said is that in terms of Apple's own obligation, arguing it in terms of testimony, you have information that's useful to prosecution, the answer is no, we don't. And therefore, I don't think from a Jewish law perspective they would have to tell. However, in terms of protecting victims and this issue of not standing by while someone's blood is shed, they are responsible in Jewish law. Secular law would say, potentially would say no. First of all, it's a may, not a must. And second of all, you can't identify who the victims are. But I think in the Jewish law, I suspect that there would be an obligation.
I don't think that necessarily means under the Personal Health Information Act or the LSUC that this, by saying may, that it's discretionary. The purpose, or certainly not exactly necessarily to say that the law, the purpose of both of these things is just to say that normally you're forbidden, but you may do it.
Right,
it's
so...
the governing body saying right. It's permissible, excuse me.
Yeah, I've heard that argument. Right, I've heard that argument made because I've spoken on the confidentiality issue, but my understanding is that Sarah is saying that it actually is discretionary.
Well, it is up to the lawyer, but...
They cannot be tried for failing to convey the information. If they fail to convey, unless it's somebody for whom they have responsibility, there's a special relationship already there, they will not be held responsible for failing to convey it.
But what the law society is doing is saying, we're not forbidding it. Only you can do it, but whether you do it or not.
I understand what you're saying, but it's not the way it's taken. In Ontario, it's not the way it's taken. I'm going to go further because, again, there's more of substance that we have to talk about. Let's say Apple does have an obligation. They refuse. Does the government have the ability to compel? So two different approaches. If I take approach number one, that it's about getting testimony, there is a concept of subpoenaing testimony in Jewish law. Saying that, no, you have to testify, and that's just the way it goes. I brought you a few sources. Source number 13, the passage in the Code of Jewish Law that requires people to testify, as we've already spoken about, and the ability of government is there, so it appears, to require testimony. I'm skipping a little bit in the interests of time. But even where the person has taken a pledge of secrecy, let's say the company says, we have a contract with the people who buy our phones, and it says that we're not going to crack their phones. Or, as it comes up for physicians, they have a physician's oath, and they are required to observe confidentiality. That is overridden as well, potentially, and I brought you sources to that effect, in source number 16, where Maimonides says that an oath of, I will not testify, is considered an oath in vain, and that's brought in the Code of Jewish Law. And second, in source number 17, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, saying that even if somebody swears not to reveal something, if the community issues a ban, a decree of excommunication on for failure to reveal it, he then will be obligated to reveal it. So, if we held that you had to give over testimony, then the government could even force you to do so. Where it gets more interesting is the question of protecting citizens. We have a principle in the Talmud which says, "Kofin al mitzvahs aseh." You compel people to fulfill active mitzvah. Meaning, if somebody says, "I don't want to fulfill this mitzvah that requires a certain action," you are able, Jewish courts are able, to say, too bad, we want you to do it, and can have a certain certain means of compulsion that they can use. However, this isn't a mitzvah aseh. This isn't an active mitzvah. This is a prohibition of don't stand by. Will they be able to compel for that? So Rabbi Yosef Babad, in source number 19, said yes. He said, even if he violates by omission, we do compel. He says it would be an obligation that that we could actually force somebody to follow. However, I want to note what I skipped, actually, number 18. I'm racing a little bit, but I hope it will be clear. Number 18 is actually a key source, which I should spend some time with. What about the concern I mentioned before, that this is dangerous for Apple themselves? They're going to harm themselves in order to do this. So Yosef Shalom Eliashiv was asked this question regarding a doctor. The doctor has a young woman who is a patient of his. The young woman has certain health risks. She is dating a guy. Does the doctor have an obligation to tell the guy about the health risks that this woman is keeping a secret from her intended spouse? And he argues that even though there is harm to the doctor, because if he divulges it, he's breaking the rules. He can lose his job. He still has to tell, but he qualifies it. What I brought you in number 18, he says, if there is concern that his livelihood might be destroyed, right, because he's going to lose his license, he need not create upheaval by telling, where there is a 10% chance that he is wrong, and this would destroy his livelihood. Even if it's just a small chance, 10% is considered to be sort of a minimal threshold for something that could happen. If there's a chance that he's wrong about all this, there is no risk, actually, then he would not need to destroy his livelihood in order to convey the information. Now, the truth is, this is a hotly debated topic, but I wanted to bring the source to show that Apple's concern about its business is not a small thing. You know, you don't say, well, we're saving lives, therefore too bad. It doesn't work that way. There actually is a substantive issue to be discussed. So to sum up what we've said in this regard, number one, we've said that there is a concept of subverting individual privacy rights to protect the judicial system, but it likely doesn't apply to Apple in this case because they don't have the information. Number two, there is a concept of subverting individual privacy rights in order to protect potential victims. That there is. And government could even compel for it. However, if that will harm the witness, then you need to have some level of certainty that there's information here that's important to save people's lives. Not just, we want to make sure that we have access to everything possible. And again, this can be more complex than that. We're doing this as a short lunch and learn. But I want to make sure to get to topic number three. How are we doing on time? Okay, so I'm going to do number three fairly quickly. But it's an interesting topic, and so I'll mention it. What about spouses? One spouse suspects the other one of infidelity or impropriety with their finances. Is that spouse able to read the email and so forth? So if this were, if we had more time with it, I would open it for discussion, but I'm just going to present two justifications that are brought for the spouse spying on the other. Note that none of this is meant to justify a sting operation. Those are a bad idea, and there are a lot of sources that I could bring you on that. This is not justification for a sting operation. And number two, as with all practical issues, please see your rabbi. The two points are this. One is brought by Rabbi Shlomo Dykovsky in the journal Tchumen. He says, well, first of all, it's really three justifications, I suppose. Justification number one goes to the point of Rabbeinu Gershom's decree, where he said, don't read other people's mail. So he brings from source number 20, Rabbi Chaim Palagi, who said that if the basis for this rule of not opening mail is because of the mitzvah of love your neighbor as yourself, well, the mitzvah of love my neighbor as myself does not extend to where I suspect that I'm going to get hurt. Love your neighbor as yourself doesn't mean expose yourself to harm. And therefore, he argues, Rabbi Dykovsky argues, don't apply Rabbeinu Gershom's ban on reading mail. That's number one. Number two, he brings a very interesting point regarding the ketubah, right? The religious marriage contract that we use has a clause in it. It says, Va'al yavrichu va'al ya'alimu lozemi zu v'lo zumi ze. They shall not hide things from each other. And on that basis, take a look, it's not in the ketubah, sorry, it's in the Tanaim. But take a look at source number 21. He says, there is room for the view that there is no issue of invasion of privacy between spouses. For the Tanaim text arranged before marriage says, they will neither hide nor conceal, neither him from her nor her from him. They will live in love and affection, etc., etc. And he says, even if this is not a financial obligation, what we're talking about, this issue that's being divulged, there is at least a personal obligation not to hide or conceal things. The reason he says that is because he's cheating when he brings this clause. Because what's missing in his quote is the quote actually says, they will neither hide nor conceal any money in the world. Rather, they will control their assets together and so forth. So in other words, what the ketubah is talking about is a financial thing. Financial openness. Not openness in everything. And therefore, that clause may not really be an adequate basis for what he's saying. But his argument is, you get married, you agree to openness, and therefore there's no problem of espionage. Clear? Again, I think I'm skeptical on it. That's, I think, why he adds at the end. He says, well, there's a personal obligation not to hide or conceal things. Maybe. But the third point is Rabbi Tzvi Spitz, and he quotes source number 23, which is a responsum of the Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet. He's dealing with a case of infidelity. One of the rules, just one second. One of the laws that surround infidelity is that in the event that that one of the spouses was unfaithful, that may trigger an obligation for the other spouse to divorce, depending on circumstances beyond the scope of what we're talking about. But he says, if you don't allow them to find out what's going on, you could be putting them in a situation in which they will be required to stay in a marriage in which halakhically they're not supposed to stay. And therefore, the argument is that they should be justified in doing this. So what we've seen are three justifications. Justification number one is the prohibition against reading others' mail may not apply if it's going to hurt me. If the prohibition is really based on love your neighbor as yourself. Justification number two is the ketubah says we're not supposed to hide things from each other, although that may really be about financial rather than other areas. And justification number three is I need to know whether I'm halakhically permitted to be in this marriage, and therefore I should have the information. Those are the three justifications potentially for it. This is a really fraught issue and requires counseling by professionals in order to deal with it. This isn't something that should be dealt with, you know, in an off-the-cuff way, really. I just brought it because I was asked about it, and it is an outgrowth of this discussion. Yes?
You were quoting God too, like,
yeah.
In terms of disclosure, to me that sounded like a positive act of openness rather than a situation where somebody uses the ketubah as a basis for which to access information when they suspect something. That's already a situation that is somewhat a deterioration.
Yes.
It's not that positive act. So I'm not quite sure about the example of the ketubah, where it's, I think it's intended to be a positive act, would be applicable
right.
In a situation where one is really
right.
In a situation which is already deteriorating.
Right.
Or has deteriorated.
To which, it's an interesting point, but to which my response would be that you don't put something into a contract unless you're ready for it to be used against you. It may be a positive expression of we will be open with each other, but be ready for the lawyer for the other side to say, noobs, you have to be open with each other, and that entitles us to make sure that everything is open. I think you're right that it's intended as a nice positive, but yeah, it has teeth. I'm going to turn the floor over to Ralph to please make the announcement that Jonathan was going to make an announcement, but since he's ill, Ralph is kind.